You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning and welcome to all of you. I'm Tanvi Madan, Director of the India Project and Fellow in the Foreign Policy Program here at Brookings. We're here today to discuss the largest democratic exercise in the world and the results that came out just yesterday. Over 600 million Indian voters went to the polls over the last few weeks, and a significant number of them chose to return Prime Minister Modi and his Bharatiya Janata Party to office for a second term with, to use an Indianism, a thumping majority. While the Prime Minister's re-election was expected, the scale of his victory has come as a surprise, and you've heard probably a lot of analysis over the last kind of 24 hours about that. The BJP increased its tally from 282 to 303. As you know, the required amount for a majority was 272. And with its coalition partners, it'll have close to, or perhaps just over 350 of the 542 seats that were contested. And we're here today to discuss kind of the results, the significance of them, the impact it will have on India's political landscape, its economic policy, its social policy, as well as its approach to the world. And joining me today, we have an excellent panel of analysts who have been observing these elections from pretty different angles. Dr. Alyssa Ayres, Senior Fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. Dr. Ishwar Prasad, who's a Senior Fellow in Global Economy and Development Program here at Brookings. And Dr. Milind Vaishnav, Director and Senior Fellow in the South Asia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace next door. Milind's going to get us started by walking us through the results. He's our domestic politics wonk and has been talking us through these elections over the last few months. So, Milind, over to you.
Thank you very much, Tanvi. It's great to be here. I think one has to be humble at moments like this when we've just witnessed such a sort of earthquake, a political earthquake in India, that we're less than 24 hours out, and we don't have all of the data to really fully understand what took place. So what I'm going to show you are just some very provisional numbers and thoughts and analyses from the data that we do have, starting here with the fact that, as Tanvi mentioned, the BJP's win in 2014 was big, and the victory in 2019 was even bigger. If you look at the map, from a distance, probably those of you in the back of the room may not see that much difference in terms of the areas of saffron where the BJP did well, and the areas of blue where the Congress did well, and then the gray there are the other parties that are the regional parties, some of whom are allied with either the BJP or the Congress. But I would just mention sort of three things that I found quite interesting. Number one is the ability of the BJP to once again dominate across the Hindi belt. 75% of the BJP's parliamentary tally last time came from just 8 states. And a lot of people said that that was a kind of black swan, right? The kind of a lightning strike. It couldn't be replicated. Well, it's basically been replicated, 5 years later. There was some attrition in the state of Uttar Pradesh, not much, a little more than 10 seats. But again, going up against a combined opposition of the SP and the BSP, which on paper anyway, when you add up their vote shares, were thought to be giving the BJP a pretty tough fight, did not really materialize. The second interesting aspect, I think, of the map, if you look in the eastern part, are the significant gains that the BJP made in 2 eastern states, West Bengal and Odisha. These are 2 states that BJP Party President Amit Shah had targeted for many years, saying that I think somewhat anticipating the fact that their numbers could go down in the north and western parts of India as places that were ripe for the BJP to sort of make inroads. They have now fully consolidated their position as the principal opposition force in both Bengal and Odisha. And that's quite striking when you think about, you know, the knock on the BJP has always been that this is a party of Hindi-speaking northerners who would always struggle to break in that eastern corridor where politics is really much more dominated by linguistic, subnational identity and very strong regional parties. The third interesting thing is that the BJP did quite well in Karnataka, which is their kind of lone southern foothold, but they also won some seats in the state of Telangana. Now, Telangana advanced its state assembly elections to last December when the ruling TRS won a thumping majority in the assembly elections. They were thought to sweep once more in the national polls, and while they did quite well, the BJP did end up winning some seats in Telangana. So that gives them now a second southern foothold in addition to Karnataka to start to expand the party even further. If you look at the All India vote share, of course, the striking thing is the rise in the BJP's vote share to about 38%. The combined NDA won about 50% of the All India vote, which for those of you who have been following Indian politics is truly stunning. But two other interesting things jump out at me from this figure. One is that the Congress kind of leveled off, right? So they seem to have a floor of about 19-20%. That is a sort of captive vote bank. So, I mean, you could look at that as maybe consolation prize that this, you know, whatever their foibles, that, you know, one out of five Indians is still voting for the Congress. But the last six or so election cycles, we've seen this 50-50 split. 50% of the vote goes to one of the two national parties. The other 50% of the vote goes to regional parties. We've seen that regional party vote share come down significantly. Some of the biggest gains the BJP made this time were at the expense of many regional parties. If you look at the state-level vote shares, there were over a dozen states where the BJP got more than 50% of the vote share, right? 50% of the vote share. And you can see that in many of these states, whether it's Gujarat, whether it's Rajasthan, Delhi, almost across the board, with the one exception here of Goa, they actually did one better on where how the party performed in 2014. We had this debate as political scientists back in 2014 about whether or not this was the era of a new party system, right? So India has had three party systems since independence. The first, which was from about 1952 to 1967, was characterized by Congress dominance, both in terms of the national power in Delhi as well as in the states. From 67 to 89 was a period where Congress remained dominant nationally, but really started to see caste base and regional parties eat into its support base at the state level. And then for the quarter century between 1989 and 2014, or what's known as the third party system, there really wasn't a single gravitational force or central pole around which politics revolved, right? We had a series of often very messy coalitions where neither the Congress nor the BJP was a reliable central force. Now, in 2014, many of us talked about, you know, the dawn of a fourth party system where essentially the BJP replaced the Congress as the dominant player. And I think 2019 further gives credence to this idea that we are, in fact, in a new era. You know, if lightning struck in 2014, it's not just that lightning has struck again, it's that, you know, climate change has occurred and the whole ground has really shifted. And I think we need to start reckoning with that. And what are some of the attributes of that? Well, number one is the electoral arena has actually become less competitive. So this is a measure of effective number of parties. So this is essentially weighing political parties by the number of seats that they earn so that you don't treat, you know, parties that got one seat and parties that got 50 seats the same. And there are effectively three parties now represented in parliament, which, as you can see here, is a real departure from what we have seen in the post-coalition era, the 1989 to 2009 era. It's become less competitive, even from what we saw in 2014. The margins of victory are getting even bigger, right? So we had seen a pretty steady decline over the years, and margin of victory is simply the distance in the vote share of the winner and the runner-up. And we've seen that increasing, meaning people are winning with bigger margins than they have in the past. If you look at the number of constituencies where the winning party won 50%+ of the vote, that has shot up over the last two election cycles, right? Many people used to say, when you have three or four competitive parties in an Indian election, you can win in a first-past-the-post system with 25-30% of the vote, right? Because the vote is essentially fragmented. We've seen a real consolidation in vote share rather than a continued fragmentation. All right, so if we're in this era of the fourth-party system, you know, what is it that drove voters to vote the way that they did this time? I mean, obviously, it's very easy for me to kind of Monday morning quarterback and tell you the answer. I think we're going to need months, if not years, to pore over the data to sort of get a sufficient answer. But let me just show you a couple of data points that I thought were quite interesting. One is, and this comes from the CSDS, which is the only social science research organization to do polling in India. And they have done a pre-poll and a post-poll. So you can kind of compare and look at the time series. 32% of BJP voters would have not voted for the NDA if Modi was not the prime ministerial candidate, right? Which tells you something about how important leadership was in terms of how people made their voting choices, right? This idea that Modi is a decisive leader who is incorruptible, who operates with clean intent, who operates with the national interest at heart, is something that I think many voters, particularly in northern India, really latched onto. Now, a lot of people, including myself, ahead of this election said, look, there are a lot of economic indicators that suggest this could be a rocky ride for Modi, right? We have an unemployment issue. We have a slowdown in growth. We have historically low farm prices. We have rural wage stagnation, right? So a number of things you could point to. Now, what's quite interesting about the campaign is that jobs actually became less salient as the campaign went along. So this year is the percentage of respondents in the CSDS surveys for whom unemployment is the biggest problem. And you can see here that it actually declined from March 2019, the month before the campaign started, to the post-poll when this was carried out. So about 21% of respondents to this national survey said unemployment was the single most important issue. That actually declined by about 10 percentage points by the end of the campaign. If you look at economic issues at large, about 35% said the economy was the most important issue. This includes jobs, includes things like GST, it includes inflation, includes a whole number of things. That declined by about 12 percentage points over the course of the election. And so, you know, one way of thinking about this, you know, I had written a piece a while ago saying that voters were looking for an excuse to vote for Narendra Modi. Now, a lot of people took issue with this word excuse, saying we don't need an excuse. We have plenty of affirmative reasons to vote for Mr. Modi. But the idea is that because people valued his leadership, even though there were economic woes in the country, they view him as the best person, the person best suited to deal with those or address those economic woes. So a friend and fellow political scientist Nilanjan Sarkar had a very nice tweet yesterday where he said, you know, typically when we watch election campaigns, we say, okay, what are the issues, national security, unemployment, inflation, okay, how does that map onto people's partisan preferences? In this case, you know, I would say maybe the opposite happened. People identified that they really wanted Modi and then found empirical ways of kind of supporting or making the case for who they wanted to vote for or why they wanted to vote for him. This issue, I think, is going to be unresolved of what impact Indo-Pak tensions had on the vote. I think one can say with some confidence that it likely provided the BJP with a bump. Some of the survey evidence we have suggests that people who were aware and who followed the news about the terror attacks in India and the subsequent response devalued the economy at the expense of other issues like national security, like leadership, like having a sort of decisive leader like Narendra Modi. The pre-polls from CSDS suggested that the NDA was tipped to do quite well, to form roughly a majority on its own. So it could be that what happened through the course of the campaign is it really magnified that lead and made it even bigger, and Balakot is potentially, you know, one aspect of that. Let me just end here so I don't take too much time, just talking about some of the other big winners other than the BJP. The first that I would point to is the YSR Congress Party of Jagan Reddy, which has now not just swept the parliamentary polls in the state of Andhra Pradesh, has also swept the assembly elections, which were happening simultaneously. This is interesting because Jagan Reddy was the son of the former Congress Chief Minister YSR. He was essentially booted out of the Congress Party. He thought that he was the rightful inheritor to his father's legacy due to tussles with the Congress leadership and the fact that he was indicted on federal corruption charges. The Congress set him aside. It turns out that that may have been a mistake. Voters overlooked all of that and have given him a resounding mandate. So he is now a pivotal leader. Chandrababu Naidu, who may be the darling of the donors of Silicon Valley, of multinational corporations, really was hurt very badly in these elections. The second is the DMK, which is the party that did very well, won about 23 seats in the state of Tamil Nadu. Had been in the wilderness for the past several of years. Both Tamil parties, the ADMK, which is the incumbent at the state level, and the DMK have experienced leadership transitions. But the DMK seems to have come out of that quite well. In fact, if you look at how the UPA did, one reason that their seats went up is because the DMK has given them, you know, 22, 23 seats. The last person I'd mention here is Nitish Kumar. I mean, if there is a man in Indian politics who has nine lives, it is Nitish Kumar. Here's a man who began his career as an explicitly anti-BJP figure, who then joined the NDA, who then left the NDA, who then was by his own, won two seats last time and rejoined the NDA, and has now won 16 seats. So he becomes once more a pivotal player in North India. Who are the big losers, again, other than the Congress? I think we'll talk a lot about the Congress in the Q&A. One is Mundal politics, right? So there were a series of political parties in North India, caste-based parties, who rose on the backs of backward caste empowerment and caste politics in the wake of the Mundal Commission, which gave reservations for backward caste in educational universities and public sector positions and civil service jobs. Whether it's the RJD of Lalu Prasad Yadav, the two big regional parties in Uttar Pradesh, the SP and the BSP, a lot of these parties did quite poorly. Now, Mayawati, the leader of the BSP, did manage to win double digits in terms of seats. She won zero seats in 2014, so in that way it's an improvement. But this combine of the SP BSP, which had hoped to prevent the BJP from sweeping Uttar Pradesh, did not succeed in that objective. The second loser is Arvind Kejriwal and the Aam Aadmi Party. I mean, if there was a party that people had tipped to potentially grow into a third national political alternative, it was the Aam Aadmi Party. They were humbled this election. They won just one seat in the state of Punjab. The seven seats of New Delhi, which where the Aam Aadmi Party is the ruling party at the state, for the second election in a row have all gone to the BJP. And the third I'll just mention here is the left, right? We've seen a precipitous decline in the fortunes of left parties in India. At this point, they really, other than Kerala, have nary a foothold elsewhere. They've been badly hurt in West Bengal. We've seen a lot of folks who supported the left in Bengal move their support to the BJP as a way of combating Mamata Banerjee and the Trinamool Congress. Let me just end here, if I might, with some questions about us as political analysts and how we need to, I think, introspect as we move forward. You know, many of us predicted a BJP victory, but very few predicted a victory of this magnitude, right? So I think we have to ask ourselves, you know, how did we miss something of this size? Now, fair enough that many within the BJP, I think, didn't predict that the victory was going to be quite as large as it was. But I think there are a couple of questions that resonate for me. One is, you know, what role do differing conceptions of nationalism play, right? So we've talked about the idea that the secularism of the Congress is discredited. And are we in a new place where essentially Hindu majoritarianism, nationalism of a right-wing variety is essentially the dominant ideology, of the country? I thought Mihir Sharma had a very perceptive piece for NDTV where he said, we have a different idea of India now that's dominant. And I think those of us who disagree with it have to reckon with the fact that a large swath of the country, which previously didn't identify with that kind of ideology, has now become converted to that way of thinking. The second is this issue I mentioned earlier, which is it issues that are shaping partisan attachments, or is it actually happening the sort of other way around, right? That people are kind of filtering everything through their affinity with the BJP, or more likely their affinity with Modi. And the last thing I'll just mention here are, how big are campaign effects? This is something historically we have not been very good at quantifying in India. But clearly there are some things that happened in the campaign that could have contributed to this kind of historic verdict. And I think that we're still struggling with understanding, whether it's money, whether it's organization, whether it's media, whether it's this idea of presidentializing a parliamentary system. These are all factors that I think we need to disentangle. So let me stop there and turn it over to my colleagues. I'll just go back to the... I'll keep the map up there maybe.
There we go. When we did this in 2014, I kind of went to the panel and said, what did we get wrong? And I think Milan's kind of previewed some of that. But just to kind of reiterate the sense of kind of how historic this is in terms of India's independent history, we've not seen a party win back-to-back majorities on its own since 1984. And in that 84 election, the BJP won 2 seats, and it's gone to kind of over 300. But also, in independent India's history, no party other than the Indian National Congress of Jawaharlal Nehru and Indira Gandhi had won this kind of majority. So just to put that a little bit in perspective, that this is quite significant. We use the term historic a lot, but this is, I think this actually does meet that threshold. Ishwar, I'm going to start with you. As Milan mentioned, kind of a lot of the rhetoric, particularly kind of in the kind of national press and the election that the politicians were using, ended up focusing a lot on kind of leadership, national security, in a way that wouldn't have expected. Usually a lot more rhetoric and narrative about the economy. Having said that, that is still often the key issue for many voters, and the elections did take place in kind of a landscape where people were talking about rural distress, people talking about kind of a somewhat, slowing economic growth rate, and kind of this need to create jobs for the next, in the next few years, and that not having been achieved the full potential, or India's growth not meeting the full potential. What do you think this is a mandate for? And different parties made different promises. What do you think this mandate is for in terms of the economy? What can we expect the Prime Minister to have to tackle? What do you think he might do over the next few months and over the next few years?
First of all, let me be clear. I did not see this coming, but clearly I'm in very distinguished company, so I feel quite comfortable about that. The superlatives about the outcome of the election have all been used up by Tanvi and Milan. So let me focus on something I'm more used to focusing on, which is the nitty-gritty issues related to economics. And it's worth thinking a little bit about where the economy is right now, what needs to be done still, and most importantly, what might be done now that Mr. Modi has this mandate. While the economy has certainly done very well in recent years, there are questions about whether the performance really matches the glorious picture painted by the official statistics. Some of those points of skepticism, I think, are well warranted, but it's hard to deny that it's been a pretty good run for India during the Modi first term. Growth overall has been pretty good. If you look at a variety of indicators of economic activity, they do point to the economy having made very significant progress. But at the same time, there is a lot that's not been done. If one looks at employment growth, if one looks at the distributional consequences of the growth, the many vulnerabilities that the Indian economy has always had, if one looks at the current account deficit, the fiscal deficit, all of those have continued. And what is remarkable is that the Indian economy has continued to turn in very good growth performance despite all of these chains still around its neck. So the question is whether we will see significant change coming in the next few years. Now, Tanvi, you mentioned that there is a mandate. So one question is, what is the message that voters were sending? Was it that they endorsed the view that Milan espoused, that there are lots of economic challenges, and while Mr. Modi may not have achieved a lot, he's the best person to push forward the economic agenda? Was it more a nationalistic approach to politics that dominated the outcomes? Was it not just nationalism, but also sectarianism that fed into it? What is equally important is not just what message was being sent, but what message is going to be read by Mr. Modi and his party, where they will see it as a mandate to push forward the social and nationalistic agenda, or a message to put forward the economic agenda. So if you think about what could be done over the next few years, it's worth thinking about what has been accomplished over the last few years. And there, it's a mixed picture. In India, as we well know, getting anything done is a challenge. And there have been some things that have been done over the last few years, some fairly important economic reforms. There is now an insolvency and bankruptcy code, which is very important from the point of view of thinking about how enterprises and their dynamism can be supported by the economy without restricting entry because exit is so difficult. There has been the introduction of a goods and services tax, certainly lots of issues with the implementation, but I think overall in the long run, it's going to be a good thing for India. There has been a move away from some public support schemes towards direct cash benefits, which I think, again, is going to pay some benefits in the long run. In all of these areas, a lot more needs to be done, but there is progress. But then if one goes back and thinks about the long laundry list that we economists of Indian origin and those looking at India always pull out, that list really hasn't changed very much over time. There needs to be substantial improvement in terms of the labor laws that still act as a chokehold on the manufacturing sector in particular, but also some of the service sector enterprises. It really constrains industrial dynamism. There are problems with the growth model. Even though industry hasn't played a very big role, the environmental consequences of growth have been crippling, especially in the major metropolitan areas. The banking system certainly is not functioning very well right now. And in all of these areas, the Modi government has certainly shown that it recognizes the need for progress. Other areas include the desperate need for better infrastructure, both physical and soft. Energy needs to be dealt with. And here again, one can think about some progress that has been made, but is this really enough for India to be able to generate what it really needs? An economy that not only generates ostensibly high GDP growth, but also the right kind of growth that is not environmentally destructive, that generates good employment outcomes, that generates broad benefits that can be translated into a big and dynamic middle class? Not quite. So if one thinks about what lies ahead in the future, the past is some guide. Mr. Modi did go in with a mandate which even at that time was considered thumping. Now I guess it's become super thumping, but it was quite a dramatic mandate that he got in his first term. And it's not just the mandate. What India had many times over the last 5 years is a very nice window of opportunity. Now, undertaking reforms in times of crisis and very difficult times is painful, but sometimes it has to be done. But it's certainly more propitious if you can undertake reforms when things are good. And things at many stages were good for India. Not only was domestic growth going along quite well, the external circumstances, which for a developing economy are very important, were also very favorable. India's current account deficit had been coming under control with low U.S. interest rates, low oil prices. India did have a window of opportunity early in the Modi term. Not much was done. Again, about 2 years ago, there was another window of opportunity. Some things were done, not much. Right now, we have a very similar set of circumstances. India seems to be growing quite well. If you look at the external circumstances, they are pretty good. The U.S. dollar is not too strong. U.S. interest rates are at a relatively low level. The rupee is at a reasonable spot at about 70 rupees to the dollar. India's current account deficit seems manageable. Oil prices at about $70 for Brent crude all portend to a very good situation in terms of reduced external vulnerabilities. So the question is, what is Mr. Modi going to do? Now, the answer to that question, I think, is going to depend not only on how the mandate is interpreted, but it's going to depend on whether he's willing to pay the political cost. Now, the reality is that in a country like India or in any country, reforms have dislocating effects. Those for whom the system currently works well, some people who are not going to be pleased with any reforms, plus invariably, those who are economically disadvantaged will feel the initial impact of any major dislocative reforms. So that takes a political price, it takes political will. In the first term, we didn't see Mr. Modi putting that up front. Will he do it now? That's the open question. The second open question is whether he has the right people around him to do this. As Milan correctly pointed out, this was a vote not so much for the BJP as for Mr. Modi. Mr. Modi may have the right intentions at heart, but there is only one Mr. Modi. The difficult question now is whether he's going to put the right people in place, technocrats who are able to take on the very difficult task of designing reforms the right way, but also thinking about how to get those reforms through, which is an equally challenging and difficult task. And again, the first term does not augur that well. The number of really capable technocrats at the senior levels, at the senior ministerial levels, was frankly quite limited, and even some of those people did not last very long. So the big question right now is whether Mr. Modi will, galvanized by the tremendous mandate he has gotten, surround himself with the right people and be willing to pay the political cost for what needs to be done. So this is, again, a great time for India. I think the world is going to be looking with much favor upon India because it looks like the right configuration of circumstances. Domestic vulnerabilities are quite limited at the moment, at least in the short term. The external vulnerabilities are limited. If you think about political stability, certainly India has it for the foreseeable future. So it ain't going to better. And I hope that Mr. Modi will push forward, but it's going to have to be something we wait and see.
Thanks, Ishwar. Alyssa, usually in Indian elections, those of us who kind of work on India's external engagements, foreign security policy, trade, etc., we kind of get a little bit of a breather till the results actually come out. You know, Mila and Ishwar and others are very busy, and we kind of wait when the election results come out. We say, what does this all mean for foreign security and trade policy?
Very busy week.
Exactly. This election, not least because of what Milan talked about, Balakot, which was followed the terrorist attack in India, and then the Indian Air Force strike in Pakistan, and then the Pakistani response. All that kind of meant that a national security rhetoric was probably at its peak in terms of Indian elections. So we talked a lot about this in the election itself. Give us a sense of whether you think that was kind of effective, played a role, but more than that, kind of what is this a mandate for? What are we going to see next in terms of this kind of foreign security trade landscape? And what do you think kind of are the things that lie ahead that need to be done?
Thank you. So I want to echo my co-panelists here. I agree with the questions that Milan raised and that Ishwar raised. about the fact that we don't have a good sense of what this actually is a mandate for. The fact that national security was such a large component of the campaign process in this election, A, it was quite unique. We haven't seen that in a few decades in India. B, it makes it even harder to parse out what voters were voting for. So questions like, were voters voting for someone that they felt, a party that they felt would stand up to Pakistan? Just to briefly refresh what happened, I'm not going to assume that everybody in the room knows, but there was a terrorist attack that took place in Kashmir on February 14th, almost immediately claimed by a terrorist group that's based in Pakistan, although the suicide attacker was from Kashmir in India. And the Indian government decided to respond by using airstrikes. So it sent missiles, used airplanes to cross the border and launch airstrikes on a target in Pakistan that they said was the a location of where this terrorist group, the Jaish-e-Mohammed, had a facility. There are a whole lot of other questions that have emerged from that process. The following day, Pakistan scrambled jets, mounted kind of retaliatory strikes in India. This resulted in an Indian Air Force pilot being downed. He was in Pakistani custody for 3 days and then returned back to India. There's a whole array of questions. There's a whole lot of questions that emerged from the events of February for which there are not 100% clear and confirmed answers. And I'm not going to address any of those because I don't think it's actually important to what happened in this election. I think that what voters in India saw, heard, and believe is that they have a leader in the BJP government and in Prime Minister Modi who will stand up in a strong way to terrorism emanating from Pakistan. I also believe that we have seen over the course of decades in the pattern of India-Pakistan tensions where you have some sort of dialogue between India and Pakistan underway only to be disrupted by a terrible terrorist attack that takes place in India and that puts a stop to everything that's been happening. I think in India, parties across the board are tired of this dynamic. They're tired of the tensions and problems with Pakistan. They're tired of feeling like every effort to reach out the hand of friendship. I mean, Vajpayee reached out the hand of friendship. Manmohan Singh reached out the hand of friendship. Modi reached out the hand of friendship early in his first term. And you see that this doesn't meet with an equal hand of friendship that includes putting a stop to the terrorist groups that emanate from Pakistan. So I think people are very frustrated with that, and the idea that the Modi government has been willing to carry out a level of military escalation to provide what is often referred to in India as a befitting response, I think that's something that certainly would have played a role. How much of a role in voters' minds, I think we don't have the answer to that. And I look forward to what political scientists and journalists who do a lot of grassroots work and interviewing will elicit from this. I think it's very important. I want to say a few other things about the question of the mandate, because this relates to expectations, certainly in the United States and in other countries outside of India, for what this will mean economically. I think that there is a sense right now from some people in the United States that Mr. Modi is a reformer and that this is a mandate for reform, and we're likely to see a sort of sweeping series of steps for economic reform. Like Ishwar, I'm just not sure that that is exactly what people thought they were voting for. And I'm also not sure that when I say reform or you say reform and people in India say reform, I'm not sure we're talking about all the same things. Mr. Modi has been, as Ishwar said, he did implement quite early on in his first term a series of important reforms. The actual sort of policy level reforms began to decline later in the term. But one of the things that he is very good at and that his government is very good at are development projects, which many people may interpret as reforms. So the Clean India campaign, keeping the country clean, building toilets, making sure that nearly all of Indian villages have access to a toilet, completing an electrification program, a program that assures that women have access to cooking gas cylinders, a housing program that supports housing development for lower incomes, the world's largest health insurance plan. I mean, you could kind of create a very long list of these very important programs that Mr. Modi has implemented. I'm not sure that they are exactly reforms. Let's take another example, the Make in India program. This exact same policy program was called the National Manufacturing Policy under the Congress-led UPA government. I know that the Make in India program, which is designed to help boost the component of India's GDP that the manufacturing sector contributes, it has not remotely met that target because the percentage of GDP that manufacturing contributes really hasn't budged in the last 5 years. On the other hand, there's increased interest from some companies around the world in setting up some manufacturing in India. Has it produced the level of investment that people have hoped for? Not yet. Some of the most important challenges in the context of trying to boost manufacturing as a way to further developing the India economy, creating jobs, boosting levels of prosperity, growing the middle class. Some of the other things that haven't happened are these very important labor and land reforms that Ishar spoke of, because that's actually crucial to creating the economic context to get India to a better place where it can be a much more powerful manufacturing power. I would also add on the heels of what Ishar said that the external scenario with China moving out of labor-intensive manufacturing actually creates a real opportunity for India if the context within India can meet that challenge. I want to say a couple other things about this mandate because it'll be very important. Oh, so just to complete that thought, when we are talking about reforms in the United States and with the U.S. Business Committee, I'm just not sure that the U.S. idea of what reform means is the same thing that people in India are talking about. I think people may be focused on these development projects as important components of transforming the quality of life in India, but it is not the same thing as making the economy, making the market much more open to the world. A couple other things that I think are important in analyzing what this mandate means. We have spoken about the idea of whether Mr. Modi is a strong leader. I think that's probably a very important component of this. We have spoken about the idea of that he's incorruptible and hardworking, so the persona of the leader as an important component of the mandate. We haven't fully spoken about is the component of this that we can attribute to Hindu nationalism, the idea of Hindutva, the idea of Hindu pride. These are shades of a sense of nationalism. At the far end of this, you get something that begins to look like sectarianism and a demonizing of some of India's minorities. And this is where I think some of the discussion that emerged in this campaign having to do with the problem of terrorism emanating from Pakistan began to touch some of these domestic questions as well. So you had comments like campaign comments from the chief minister of Uttar Pradesh, Yogi Adityanath, referring to the Congress Party as suffering from a green virus, you know, sort of coded language. You had the idea, you sometimes see campaign comments from people that Muslims should go to Pakistan. Well, why should Indian Muslims go to Pakistan? It's evident that by the fact that Indian Muslims are in India that they didn't choose to go to Pakistan in 1947. So you did see, I think, a bit of shading of this question, and I think that the Hindutva piece in this campaign was much, much stronger than it was in 2014. And that is something that I think people are going to have to reckon with going down the line. I think there's one last piece I want to say about the mandate, and that is, to what extent was this a vote for best option given the options before people? And I don't know the answer to that, and I hope that political scientists will start to elicit more of that, because it's pretty hard to determine, but probably quite important, particularly given the roster of big losers that you mentioned. I mean, this is, what does this really mean? What can we make of this from this election? So I throw that out as a series of questions. Thanks.
Thanks, Alyssa. And kind of added to that list, and Milan, I hope you're taking notes, because this is all for you know, those of you who do domestic political analysis, is kind of how do you disaggregate what nationalism means? I mean, because in this election, as you mentioned, there was a kind of a lot of not just dog whistling, but whistling on the Hindu nationalism. But more so than that, there was this thing of Indian nationalism. kind of an assertive India, an India that has a kind of large and respected role on the world stage that was very much put out there, not just kind of with the incidents you mentioned, but also kind of the anti-satellite test that was put out and very much publicized as well, kind of talking about India in the big leagues, so to speak. Milan, I want to come back to you to talk about kind of, you know, as you said, you put it up there in kind of the title with the kind of who are the losers this election, who's had not just a bad day, but perhaps a really bad set of weeks, the Congress Party. One of the things that is going to be also kind of historic is for them, which is that by 2024, the decade that they would have been out of power would be the longest time that they've ever spent out of power at the center. Where does this party go from here? What do you think the lessons, what lessons will they learn? What lessons do they need to learn? And what's your sense of will they learn them?
I guess I would preface my comments by saying, you know, the Congress Party is not a party given to true and deep self-reflection and introspection. And so many of the existential questions that we're debating today about the future of the Congress are frankly the same questions we were asking in 2014. And they relate principally to two things, which is a deficit of leadership and a deficit of ideology, and sort of what is their affirmative vision. I'll begin maybe by just saying why I'm skeptical. I put the graph up there on the All India vote share, right? And so there is still a base across the country, although in more limited pockets now, of around 19 or 20% of the population, which still remains with the Congress. But even beyond that, if you look subnationally, there are enough states in India at present, which are two-party states, which feature bipolar competition between the Congress and the BJP. So these are states like Gujarat, like Rajasthan, like Madhya Pradesh, like Chhattisgarh. Several of these states where the Congress actually did quite well in the recent assembly elections. And so to the extent that there is a repository for anti-incumbency or anti-BJP votes, the Congress is the only one who can exploit that vulnerability. Until and unless we see a third party emerge in these two-party states, frankly, the Congress is the only other game in town. So I think that in some ways takes the edge off the existential crisis, right? Because they can revert sort of back to that. Now, when it comes to these larger issues, I'll just state the obvious, which is that there remains a very deep fear in the party that if you subtract the family from the party, then you have no party anymore. That if you were to take the Gandhi family and replace them with somebody else, that the party would simply fragment into several regional franchises, right? So the Tamil Nadu Congress would become a party and the Maharashtra Congress would become a party. We've seen some of that in years past. I mean, that's how people like Mamata Banerjee and Sharad Pawar and other Jagan Reddy essentially got their start. And so this leadership deficit, you know, dynastic succession is great insofar as it allows for easy transition planning from one leader to the next. It's not so great when you get down to the gene pool and you end up with someone who doesn't really have the stuff, and then you've had a roadblock. And you know, I think most people would say that Rahul Gandhi, and the polls bear this out, has become more persistent, more effective, more diligent, but the gap still remains quite substantial between him and Mr. Modi. And I think one of the big mistakes of the Congress tactically was, I think, to train all of their guns on Modi. This whole line of Chokidar Chor Hai, you know, the watchman is a thief, I think has blown up in their face, because it requires the premise of that line requires that people to actually believe that it's possible that Narendra Modi is himself on the take, right? And that's why I think all of the allegations about the Rafael scam and others really never went anywhere. So I think I don't anticipate leadership changes. The best thing the Congress could do if it's not willing to change things at the top is to adopt a more collegium-style approach where they really empower state-level political leaders. I mean, we forget that, you know, one of the real strengths of the BJP when it was in the wilderness is that it really facilitated the rise of powerful state leaders like Modi in Gujarat, like Shivraj Singh in Madhya Pradesh. So,
it was less a national party than a collection of powerful regional parties. Now, the BJP has changed its makeup, but I think that's one way the Congress could go. But they had the chance to do that in Madhya Pradesh and Rajasthan, to empower a new group of officials, and they chose really not to do that. So I don't have great hopes. In terms of the vision thing that we talk about, I think here they're really in a dangerous position, because what Modi has done so well is to really saturate the space both on the right and on the left in a way. So his notion of the public provision of private goods are really things that, all, as Ishwar mentioned, the Congress sort of began, right? And all the Congress can do is to say, well, if we were in power, we'd do it maybe better or bigger, but they can't really criticize the underlying premise of any of those schemes because they were all UPA schemes. And it's unlikely, I think, for the Congress to tact further to the right and to really adopt the kind of mantle of pro-market reforms. And so they're stuck, and they're stuck in a second way, which is the whole construct of Nehruvian secularism has been completely discredited. And it has become coterminous with...
Tell the audience that doesn't know, what is Nehruvian secularism?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically this idea that, you know, India is a complicated place, and it is the most diverse country on the planet, and so you have to find unity in its unparalleled diversity. But the particular way in which it was enshrined in the Constitution was to say, we are not going to enact a strict church-state separation as we have in the United States. We are going to have a policy whereby the state maintains an equal embrace of religion and an equal distance from religion. So we will do things like administer religious education that can receive state funding. We will subsidize religious pilgrimages. We will enact legislation to reform illiberal social practices associated with religion. But we will try to do so in an even-handed way. No one believes it can be done in an even-handed way anymore. And so until and unless they can reinvent that idea and contrast it with the kind of majoritarian nationalism we see on the other side, I think it's a one-sided debate.
So one of the things, I mean, it's interesting when you say, you know, they're kind of training all the guns on Modi and not coming out with a message. They could have learned something from Rahul Gandhi's grandmother, Indira Gandhi, who a bunch of kind of opposition parties formed kind of a coalition message, at least, that had the term Indira Hatao, remove Indira. That was their message. And she turned that around to Garibi Hatao, remove poverty, and won big. Ishwar, on that front, I mean, we talked about the economy. The BJP doesn't use the kind of term that was often used, poverty alleviation, but they do talk about kind of this inclusive growth that the UPA also talked about. It's, you know, I think one of the things you pointed out is it's not just what we think the mandate is, it is what the parties think the mandate was for. And there was a sense that when the BJP-led coalition lost re-election in 2004, one of the lessons they took was that there was too much focus on this India shining, on the liberalization and reforms, and not on this kind of inclusive growth in terms of bringing, taking everybody along. We saw in this election not just the Congress Party, which promised, made a lot of promises that would require state expenditure, but the BJP do so as well. Infrastructure spending, but also welfare programs, funds for farmers. Where's all the money for this going to come from? And on a related point, I mean, if you we've heard reports that there are kind of these 100-day plans that the Prime Minister has asked for. What would be in your kind of 100-day list on the economic front to not just kind of get this India to its growth potential, but also make sure that it's kind of inclusive in its nature?
Actually, on that, there is a clear answer. There is a group of 13 of us economists led by Raghuram Rajan, Geeta Gopinath, and Abhijit Banerjee. We actually came up with an economic strategy for India, non-partisan strategy. So the plan is there if somebody is willing to take it on. But in response to your first question, I think both Milan and Alyssa have characterized it very nicely. What Modi in particular, but the Modi government more broadly did very effectively was to take up both sides of the aisle in a way that resonated with the population. On the one hand, they did talk about themselves as reformers, and this going back to the election strategy and the idea of trying to attack Modi, that did not work well because, as Milan mentioned, Modi is seen as incorruptible, and even when he had these missteps, such as the demonetization episode, the notion that it was finally a leader on the national stage who was willing to do something about this endemic problem, I think resonated very well. We saw the UP elections that came soon after the demonetization, and he did again much better than most of us who had anticipated that there would be some pushback. So I think the notion of striving towards making people's lives better, that rhetoric, he certainly framed it very well. In addition to the rhetoric of trying to improve the functioning of the economy. Now, the gap between the rhetoric and the actual delivery has been very substantial in many ways, and there are many constraints that are still out there. But the sense that there is nobody else who's willing to take on these problems without being in it for personal benefit or gain, I think is a very powerful message that Modi has managed to carry through his first term and into the second term. What he plans to do, what he's advertised he will do, is going to be challenging. One of the key problems in India is that you have a good pool of domestic savings, but you don't have a good financial system that can channel those savings into the most productive uses. So there are these constraints we've talked about already in terms of infrastructure, the labor laws, and so on. And of course, I'm partial, given my own research area, to the financial system. But I think unless India gets finance right, it's going to be very difficult to generate good growth, because without financial resources, it's difficult to get much economic dynamism in an economy. And here again, there are some positive portents with some movement in terms of banking reform, but also some worrying portents, because the really difficult banking sector reforms, which would also require some pain for certain very politically well-connected enterprises, that Mr. Modi has not been willing to undertake, because that requires a significant political cost. It is going to have a dislocating effect. On the financing side as well, the central government budget deficit certainly looks like it's coming under control, although there was a bit of slippage in the latest deficit. But again, if you put together the overall consolidated deficit of the center and state governments, then things don't look quite as good. If you look at the overall trajectory of the debt to GDP ratio, that doesn't look quite as good. But all of these are sins that can easily be forgiven, both by domestic investors, foreign investors, if there is a sense that there is a real commitment to economic reforms. And while Mr. Modi has sort of articulated this notion of trying to make sure that the poor have access to sanitary facilities, that women in particular are going to be empowered in various ways, in terms of laying out a broad vision, it's not quite there yet. And he argued at the beginning of the first term, actually, that he was just going to get things done without laying out a big vision, that what was important was what he did on the ground, not what he said. But we haven't really seen either a vision or a clear delivery of many of those things that need to be done. So I think at this stage, there is still a need for a broader vision that people can coalesce around, rather than, again, just being the best of the available options. And I hope that, again, he can recharge and reinvigorate the reform effort by laying out a clear sense of where he wants to take India on the economic front, and then rally around him the right sort of people who can get him there.
You know, you mentioned women. One of the statistics in Indian elections are always great for the statistics. One of my favorite kind of campaign statistics is always how much liquor has been confiscated by the Election Commission. And worryingly, this year there was a huge number of drugs confiscated as well. But more seriously, you know, one of the things that was really striking for me, and quite a sign of where things are and where things will go, is that, wow, you know, we heard a number about kind of record-breaking turnout, over 67%, up from even the last time, which itself was record-breaking in 2014. To me, a really kind of key figure was that the voter turnout rate, the women's turnout rate, and the men's turnout rate, that gap in 2009 was 9%. It's down to 0.4%. And I think that's a great sign. And it will, I suspect, mean that political parties have to think a lot about female voters, what they want. Do they want something different? Do they want similar things? And how to kind of actually respond to them? Alyssa, just following up on kind of this, getting back to this conversation about the economy, if you were a foreign investor, what would you be seeing, looking for signals that would make you feel positive over the next few months, and what would worry you over the next few months? And similarly, if you were a trade negotiator, what would you, or not, maybe not a negotiator, because that's always tough, but what would you be looking for India to do on the trade front?
From the investor perspective, keeping in mind that I'm not an investor, I know that it is important that this issue of ease of doing business, and that's where you've seen great progress in India during the Modi first government. They actually focused on the idea of creating a context where people would feel their investments are welcome. They use the World Bank's Ease of Doing Business Index as a kind of lodestar, a metric for what India needed to improve. And they've moved up on that list quite substantially. So that they're not cracking the top 50 yet, which was the original goal, but they've moved up from being, you know, in the lower third of the Ease of Doing Business Index. So that's been positive. I think investors appreciate that. But it doesn't mean that everything is easy. So, you know, you continue to hear stories from people about, you know, difficulties investing or large investments that find that all of a sudden somebody's got a new regulatory review, like on the issue of e-commerce, or people who are now in the quite important, let's call it the data-heavy space. I mean, India has become the world's largest open internet economy, if you think about it, just in terms of sheer number of users, platforms that are involved in India. It's because China is closed. So you start to hear a lot of questions from people about, well, what will happen in India with data localization? These are all questions that remain unanswered right now. Data nationalism is something that you're hearing a lot about. So from an investor's perspective, I think it partly depends on what space you're in, but also what the kind of future questions about sector regulation look like. And so I think that India is not necessarily the easiest place in every sector to do business. And as I mentioned earlier, I think we have seen that during the first Modi government, he is pro-business. He is willing to be seen encouraging and courting business to come to India. But he's pro-Indian business. It doesn't mean he's necessarily pro-open markets, pro-business all over the world. So I think that's an important distinction. On the trade negotiator side, I really worry that the trade frictions between India and the United States, which I could go on at length and it will bore all of you because some of these issues are extremely arcane, but I worry that these frictions may begin to affect some of the other areas of very, very positive and deepening cooperation between India and the United States. And so here, let me just say that the defense and strategic areas of cooperation have continued to advance quite substantially. We've seen under the Modi government, and we've seen this continue with the Trump administration in the United States, a deepening on interoperability, a deepening on continued exercise, the resurrection of the quadrilateral dialogue, which is I want to differentiate, this is a foreign ministries-led consultation that takes place between India, Japan, the United States, and Australia. Everybody should read Tanvi's writing on the Quad. So this has all been really positive, I think. The trade side is really hitting rocky shoals, and it has been for some time. Part of this has been because of the way the Trump administration approaches trade. The Trump administration is extremely focused in an idea of reciprocity. When I was in the Obama administration, we used to speak about our two-way trade relationship with India as relatively balanced. The Trump administration sees India as among the large economies with which we have the largest trade deficits. So that is on, you know, one of the agenda items when trade negotiators meet, is to talk about ways that India will take steps to reduce this trade deficit. Indeed, it has come down by about 7% between 2017 and 2018. It's around a $22 billion deficit. But there are a lot of other items on this list. So, for example, and some of the items on this list, the very long laundry list that Ishwar referred to, some of these items now are getting piled on with new items that the Trump administration is creating. So in 2017, the Trump administration decided to do a review of the national security implications of steel and aluminum imports to the United States. Well, it turns out that we have steel imports from India, And when they determined that there is a national security impact of steel and aluminum imports to the United States, they decided to apply tariffs, 25% tariff on steel imports, 10% tariff on aluminum imports. It turns out that we've applied this to Indian steel imports. So this is now an issue. The Indian government has developed a list of reciprocal tariffs on U.S. products, which they would apply, again, reciprocally. They've held that in abeyance while trade negotiations have been ongoing between India and the United States. But I can't help but fear that at some point the Indian government that decides to say, well, sorry, folks, it's time we're going to apply these tariffs now on a number of U.S. goods that we import, one of which would likely be almonds. It's an important import. It's an important product of California. So you have all these kind of, you know, the high-profile story on trade wars is the story of U.S.-China. But I do worry that we could find ourselves in a kind of series of escalating trade steps and reciprocal steps that start to make this trading relationship much more difficult than it already is, and it isn't easy at the best of times.
So Alyssa did allude to the fact that we have one more expert in international relations of India on our panel. So, dear moderator, could we get your views, actually? And I'm very interested, actually, to hear your thoughts, Tanvi, on what implications the elections might have for India's relationship, not just with the U.S., but as a regional power. Do you see Modi sort of growing confidently onto the international stage and trying to broker relationships with countries in the region, or do you see the party sort of constraining him into a more nationalistic mode?
I mean, I'm going to go back in some... Thanks, Ishwar, for putting me on the spot. I'm going to go back to kind of the Indira Gandhi comparison for a slightly different reason. When she won in the early kind of 70s, but also after kind of she defeated, and that's what Howard was saying, that she defeated Pakistan during what was then called the East Pakistan Crisis, what we now think of as the Bangladesh War of 1971. Even her opposition leaders, you know, kind of the urban legend is that member of parliament, Vajpayee, future prime minister, called her Ma Durga, kind of talking about this warrior queen, so to speak. But it had an impression on the neighborhood as well. Which is that it gave her a certain, the fact that she had that kind of mandate, she won a series of elections. And I can't help but think that for leaders, not just in the neighborhood watching this election, the scale of the mandate, but also Xi Jinping in China, as well as President Donald Trump, who incidentally, before he was president, was in India in 2014, just after the election, and had called Prime Minister Modi a winner then. And so it can't help but make an impression on these leaders. And I think what we're going to see now over the next few months and weeks is, and this next few years, is whether that actually translates to the kind of relationships. It's interesting, in Sri Lanka, for example, the parties that are out of power hadn't been kind of very India-friendly, so to speak. We've seen both kind of major leaders come out effusively praise Prime Minister Modi. They're also trying to make their way back into office. But I think for Xi Jinping, for example, on the China front, he had an opportunity in 2014 to kind of really... Prime Minister Modi then wanted to do business with China. He admires what they have achieved economically. But then, you know, in the first few months of the Modi administration, then we saw kind of a lot of China-India activity. But then that kind of dissipated after the September visit of Xi Jinping, which was supposed to be this kind of a major move, but got overshadowed by a boundary incident, and then a few years. The question I have on the China front is, do we see China say, listen, we have to focus on this U.S.-China competition. We want to take India, if not out of the game, but, you know, maybe build up the uncertainty they have about the U.S. and decrease their threat perception of us for a little while. Do we actually really move to accommodate some of its sensitivities substantively? I personally think we'll see a little more rhetoric. It's substantively tough for them to do that because it will mean them giving up, for example, certain things with their Pakistan relationship, making some tough decisions on the economic side. Will they do it? I don't know. If I was thinking strategically, as we are led to believe by people like Secretary Kissinger that they do, then I would, because I do think that would change. And they could say to Modi, listen, we know you want to kind of transform and focus on the Indian economy.
focus on that. I mean, I can't say more on the U.S. Side than Alyssa has. I do think there are some kind of big decisions that will need to be made, including on the defense side, on the particularly defense procurement. There have been deals that have been waiting to be signed till after the election. On the trade front, some talks have been postponed. But I do think this will make it, the scale of this victory will make an impression on President Trump. And it's interesting to me that kind of thinking about the Quad, but also the three kind of big elections we've had in the Indo-Pacific, Australia, India, Indonesia, all have returned incumbents. And so one of the things, you know, is that will bring a certain amount of stability, but what will it mean for some of kind of these larger issues? So with that, and with apologies for the moderator taking over as a discussant for a little bit, we're going to turn over to audience questions, and we've got a good amount of time for that. We'll take them in clusters. I appeal to you, please keep them short. Please identify yourself. Please keep them short so that we can get to as many questions as possible. We'll take these two and the third one there first. Thanks, Laura. And if there's a particular person you want to direct your question to, let us know that as well.
Yeah. Hi. My name is Sachin Garg. I'm a visiting assistant professor at the ISB in Mohali. So I just came to India, and I've been following these elections. So I would like to take up a couple of things about what Ishwar talked about, the whole idea of reforms, the big ones. And Alyssa touched briefly on the land reform thing. We remember that the Modi government had tried to passed the land acquisition bill, which did not pass because of a lot of intransigence by the in the Rajya Sabha. And then we have also heard about the food boot ki sarkar jaib that, and I think that actually sort of changed Modi from trying to be the outward facing person towards doing the more the social aspects, as you rightly mentioned, the whole electricity thing to everybody. And I think my perspective would be that what Milan says, the options part, largely that people want continuity, and everybody believes that given this whole stuff, something will actually come out of...
Your question, please.
My question would largely be that what would this, as you said, the mandate, what would your perceptions be about how this mandate is being going to be interpreted? Is it going to be more like what Ishwar is talking about, more outward trade focused, or the more what Alyssa is talking about is like make in India and bolster the Indian economy? What would be your perspective?
Hello, thank you. I'm Neeraj Prasad. I'm a recent PhD from the Fletcher School at Tufts University. My question is to Milan. You talked about this puzzle about whether issues say partisan affiliation or whether partition affiliation shapes issues that you choose. If you were to assume the second, that is partisan affiliation is shaping the issues that you choose, in that case, what shapes partisan affiliation? As in, why do people choose Modi over other people?
My name is Aman Thakur, and I work with the Wadhwani Chair in U.S. India Policy Studies at CSIS. My question, primarily directed to Milan, but I invite everyone else to join in, is about India's youth and the way that they voted. So 84 million new voters voted, and both in 2014 and 2019 disproportionately voted for the BJP and Prime Minister Modi. So why do you think that is? What are the driving factors? Is it the economic development angle, or are they disproportionately nationalist? And what implications does that have on politics and policy moving forward?
Hi, Chris McRae. So I was at the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank Summit in South Korea in 2017, and a point I'd like to make is that very near the top of Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank are two of Britain's most knowledgeable people about India. So there is actually a lot of attempts inside China to look at positive relationships with India when that is possible, but also to blend that with both sort of digital infrastructure as well as real infrastructure. So you do have to look, I think, at all of those things, which are probably now all up for grabs, depending on really, you know, who approaches Modi with what. And I think there's just so much going forward. I'd like to hear a bit more about that rather than, you know, the historical policy reform issues.
So we'll start with Milan. Do you want to start us off in answering those? Pick anyone you want, or if they're directed to you, please.
Yeah, let me try to take Neeraj's question. I mean, we're all kind of, I think, trying to piece together the puzzle. But, I think, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, there's certain characteristics about Narendra Modi that really seem to resonate with a broad swathe of voters. This idea that he's somebody who is a decisive leader, who understands that in a fragmented country like India, you have to centralize a certain amount of political authority and take tough decisions. Again, these are perceptions. We can debate how the perceptions translate into reality. The second is, I think this idea that he's somebody who operates with sort of, clean intent, who puts the national interest above all else. Just to go back to the demonetization example, right? One thing that you constantly heard, despite people who may have been adversely affected, is, it didn't really pan out, but at least he tried something, right? And I think the third aspect, I think, is a certain kind of muscularity. And Tanvi mentioned the different kinds of nationalisms that we've seen. I think one thing we heard on this campaign trail that we have not heard is look at India's image in the world, right? I mean, look at how people now respect us and treat us. And if I had to boil all of these things down, one of the things that we're not very good at quantifying because it's a kind of squishy concept is this idea of status and recognition. So if you look, for instance, at some of the social service delivery schemes, it's quite interesting, right? So Swachh Bharat, to give people toilets to get rid of open defecation, a lot of people say, yes, we've received the toilet, but it's not tied up to any water source. Rural electrification, yes, the village has been given electricity connection, but our household still hasn't gotten one. Cooking gas, yes, we've gotten a cooking gas connection, but we can't afford a replacement cylinder. But they have the hope that it's going to happen. And I think above all, they feel that the state, which has always been so distant and so amorphous and so uncaring, has actually kind of recognized them, right? And so I think that's a kind of psychological kind of shock that I think is something that's, again, is hard to kind of talk about tangibly, but I think is very much present. In terms of the question about youth voters, we don't know yet because we haven't gotten the disaggregated data. I mean, my suspicion would be, historically, two things have been true about the youth voter. Number one is that they have not come out to vote in as large numbers as people above them. So I'm talking here about people between the ages of 18 and 25, so largely first-time voters. And the second is that they haven't shown a very distinct partisan preference in the way that they voted. In 2014, both of those presumptions were overturned. In other words, the voting turnout rate of young voters was larger than the All India average, and that they swung decisively for Modi. In fact, if you were to plot the age distribution against your propensity to vote for the BJP, the BJP does well on all age cohorts, but their advantage gets smaller the older folks are, right? And so we don't know yet what the data shows. I would suspect that we would see a continuing sharpening of that trend that we saw in 2014 again in 2019.
Alisa, Ishwar, do you want to address any of those?
I'll just make one broader point related to some of the questions that came up. It's difficult at this stage to see direct political resistance to anything that Mr. Modi wants. And as Milan correctly pointed out, when Mr. Modi is convinced that something is really important, it will happen. It may happen in a sort of half-baked way, maybe not get implemented, but it will happen. So the question now is whether he will have the people around him who will convince him that many of the things on our laundry list are the really important things, or whether the party will essentially end up constricting him, arguing that this is a mandate for the social and nationalistic agenda rather than the economic reform agenda. So there is much to hope for, but also something to worry about.
I think that's related to the point about why are we talking about this, other than the fact that this is a discussion about the results. Is those questions of what India does with China economically, whether this infrastructure can these infrastructure promises can be fulfilled, etc. It is related to the political aspect, to what the mandate is, to what political capital is used for. And the fact that Prime Minister Modi now has it, the question is, will he use it? People were disappointed kind of in 2014 that he didn't make more of the political capital he had then and the mandate he had then. But I think this question is going to come up again. And I think that's related to the point about image. Because I don't think if we do not see the kind of promises being kind of implemented or delivered on, both kind of these foreign and domestic ones, I do think you will start to see disillusionment again, because we go in these cycles of euphoria and disillusionment about India. And what we need is really kind of a steady state of that. And I think so it will depend very much what India does at home. Will kind of drive its importance abroad and its ability to do things abroad as well. Milan?
Sure, just on the question, I think I realized the question hadn't really answered on the mandate question. I think, you know, the difficulty here is that for those who are hoping for more sweeping liberal economic reforms, there are a number of veto points and veto players within the system that one has to consider. So the first is the BJP's own base, right, where they've tried to marry social conservatives with economic conservatives, which leaves them with a very big tent party, right? So these axes have often been talked about as cow on one dimension and reforms on the other, right? And so you see people kind of in all four quadrants. And so that's a potential veto player. The veto player, which was very acute in the first term, is the upper house or the Rajya Sabha, where, again, the BJP and the NDA lacks a majority. And most projections suggest that a majority is unlikely until the very end of the second term. So I think that's something that continues. But the third one, I think, and this is just to build on Ishwar's point, is I think the biggest downside risk with respect to the economic agenda is that there is really nobody of cabinet stature or cabinet rank who represents or who has a very distinct compass around the issue of economic reform. And this is something that we've seen in all previous governments. So whether it was Mr. Chidambaram in the Congress government, whether it was Manmohan Singh before him, whether it was in the NDA government, guys like Arun Shore, Yashwant Sinha, Rangarajan, and others, they didn't always win on every policy battle that they waged, but they provided this kind of stature and core of conviction. And I think that's something that we don't see. So one of the questions is, will we see it the second time? And I think what gives people pause is that this is not a prime minister who is known to look favorably upon the creation of alternative power centers other than his own within the government. And so I would remain somewhat skeptical that we would likely see this.
So we'll take the next round of questions. We've got so let's do this way. We'll do two more rounds. If you could keep it short, we'll do the four in this side, and then we'll turn back to the other side.
Thank you for talking to us. So there's a certain view of Indian politics that, of Indian voters, that they vote primarily either for political patronage or basically considering that what a candidate, a local candidate, can do for their specific constituency. Yet, you know, as was mentioned, nearly one-third of voters might not have voted for NDA if Modi was not the candidate being put forth. So would you say that, given this, there's a certain change in the way that voters are voting for their candidates, or would this be part of the fourth sort of change that you mentioned in Indian politics? Thank you.
Hi, Isabel Hoagland with Inside U.S. Trade. I'm hoping you can elaborate on how this election will impact bilateral trade tensions and whether previous tensions will spill over and potentially escalate. What will be different and what needs to change?
Hi, thank you. This is Jay Kansar from the Hindu American Foundation. My question is primarily for Alyssa and Milan. How much analysis has gone in thus far, or how much will go into decoding the vast Muslim vote? Because Islam in India is not a monolith. India has the largest Shia population outside of Iran, and they have actually more so leaned towards the BJP. And if you could just extrapolate on that, because I think the media and the perception is that they just simply vote in a block, and I think that's incorrect.
Thank you.
I'm Arjun. I'm a student of the Georgetown India Initiative. My question is about domestic constituencies on foreign policy, right? So historically, we've seen on issues on Israel, Palestine, Iran. We've seen the DMK on Sri Lanka. We've seen the left front on Indo-US relations. They've had an impact, right? Do you think this election will change things? And although we're trying to interpret this mandate, do you think things might change in terms of how India engages economically or through its foreign policy with other countries?
Okay, let's start with Milan, Alyssa, and then we'll go to Ishwar.
Let me take the question about Islam. So what we know from the past is that, obviously and unsurprisingly, the BJP derives very small percentage of its overall vote share from the Muslim community, although between 2009 and 2014, the percentage of Muslims, this is data from CSDS again, that voted for Narendra Modi doubled. Now it doubled from about 3.5% to 4% to about 8% to 8.5%. So you could still say that's, you know, pretty small. But it was an increase. This whole idea of Muslim bloc voting is a myth, and it's been empirically disproved time and time again. If you just take the state of Uttar Pradesh, for instance, we've often talked about how Muslim voters might coalesce, say, to keep the BJP out, and so they would vote strategically. That actually has not happened. The Muslim vote is as fragmented as the Hindu vote. And part of the reason is that it's actually very hard to achieve that kind of coordination. And so you'll see votes going, small minority votes going to the BJP, but then between the SP, BSP, and Congress, you will see a fraction because it will a fragmentation. So it really depends. And that's, I think, one reason why the many people worried on the opposition side that the Congress not being part of this opposition alliance would hurt their chances because it would create a three-cornered contest between the BJP, the SP, the BSP, and the Congress. So I certainly endorse this idea that there's not that block voting and probably never has been when it comes to the Muslim community. And I'm happy to offline send you papers to that effect. On this question on voter behavior, it's a really good it's a really good question. I don't have a pat answer to, but I think certainly in this election we can say with some degree of confidence that voting really was about the person at the top of the ticket, as it were, as opposed to individual candidates. And this is something that was encouraged by the Prime Minister himself, who was very clear in 2019 saying a vote for the BJP is a vote for me. Right. And that's the most important thing. It's not the person who's on the ballot. And he was quite explicit about this. And this is actually something that he said back in Gujarat. I remember being in Gujarat in 2012, which is his last re-election, where he said the person on the ballot is irrelevant. It's really about who you get to lead the government. And so I think that certainly is a feature. And anyway, what we know historically is that candidate-level factors tend to matter somewhat less in national elections because the MP is so distant from the average voter. Where candidates tend to matter more is at kind of state election. On this issue of kind of patronage, you know, I think we're in this messy area where caste certainly matters and parochialism certainly matters, but I think it's simply not enough to rely on that. You know, if that were true, the SP, BSP would have done quite well, right? Because you just take the vote banks and you say, okay, we appeal to these backwards, these Dalits, these Muslims, and that adds up to 45%, and that's what we're going to get, and we know that doesn't translate.
So, Alyssa and Ishwar, we've got a couple of questions, one on bilateral trade, tensions, what can be done, what might we see, and then is this election kind of, does it create domestic constituencies for particular kinds of foreign policy or relationships?
Let me take the bilateral trade question. First, I think the top part of that question was, what does this election change? And I think that my view is that this election doesn't change that bilateral trade dynamic. So I think we are likely to see more of what we've been seeing in the last year and a half. And that's one of the reasons why I am concerned about this potential problem of a very important component of the overall bilateral relationship experiencing so much stress and friction, it could potentially bleed into these other areas where we actually have quite positive and deepening cooperation that would be in the strategic and defense space. So I do, you know, as I mentioned in some earlier comments, I think we do need to be aware that there are some conversations in India that may lead to a tightening focus on the idea of data localization and data privacy. This is important for people in India who view data, now you hear this quite regularly, who view data as an important national element. So that would be something that I would watch. In the last year and a half, the Modi government has raised some tariffs on some spaces, which I think has been a surprise for a lot of us who had believed that India tends to work incrementally, but still in the direction of ongoing liberalization. So seeing some tariff increases was, again, a surprise. Something I didn't mention for time reasons, but I will mention it now, was that a couple months ago, the Trump administration issued a notification of intent to remove India from the GSP program, the Program of Generalized System of Preferences, which allows India to export items into the United States duty-free. They need to take one additional step for that to become the final status. The notification, a 60-day advance notification is required, but to actually effect removing India from GSP requires another step, another issuance of a notification. That hasn't happened yet, but we may likely see that happen in the next week. Now, that would be something that is a process initiated by the Trump administration, but the Modi administration, the Modi government would likely react to it. I mentioned that they have this list of reciprocal tariffs they drew up last summer that they have continually held in abeyance. I wouldn't be surprised to see that enacted at some point, just given all these other frictions underway. So I would like to see the economic relationship continue to grow. Against this backdrop of frictions, I should say that two-way trade has continued to boom over the last 10, 15 years. It's now approaching close to, I think, $145 billion in two-way trade in goods and services. That's all very positive. But the G2G, the government-to-government piece of this, there's a whole lot of tough issues that have been very, very difficult to resolve.
Ishwar.
There's a real opportunity here to improve the relationship and for India to do some things that are good for itself. There are many markets that need to be opened in India, and this is a time when India, at least for a little while, is going to be the darling of foreign businesses, foreign investors, because the economic landscape looks good, the potential is very strong, and there is political stability. So if India were to move forward with opening up its markets, financial markets in certain parts of the economy that are restricted to foreign businesses operating there or to investing there, one could see American businesses rallying around to the side of India and trying to maintain a better relationship with India. But that proposition would have held true once upon a time, long, long ago, when U.S. trade policy was driven by logic and strategy. Now it is driven by whim, so who knows?
I was just going to say to the point, you know, it's not quite clear what the mandate in terms of foreign policy was for. There are particular issues that did come up that could have implications, for example, if they follow through on some of these policies that they were talking about in Eastern, when they were campaigning in Eastern India and kind of, register of citizens, etc. It could potentially create some problems with Bangladesh. But on kind of the China-Pakistan issues, the Prime Minister was very careful about what he said on China, moderated his tone from the previous election when he was obviously an opposition candidate. And on Pakistan, yes, he was very aggressive, but would it surprise anybody if, like all Indian leaders who come back to power or come to power, that he will try once again to at the very least get that situation stabilized somewhat so you could focus kind of on bigger things. I think on the foreign and security policy side, the big question is going to be, can India really kind of increase and improve and upgrade its capabilities? Because all this is very well in terms of specific relationships, but that's what it will come down to. Do you have the defense capabilities? Do you have the economic capabilities? Because that's what other people will react to as well. Sadly, we have run short of time, so we can't get to the other questions. I'm sorry for that, but please do join me in thanking our excellent panel, and thank you all for coming as well.